I came to love the way Maury lit up when I entered the room. He did this for many people, I know, but it was his special talent to make each visitor feel that the smile was unique. "Ah, it's my buddy," he would say when he saw me in that foggy, high-pitched voice. And it didn't stop with the greeting. When Maury was with you, he was really with you. He looked you straight in the eye, and he listened as if you were the only person in the world. How much better would people get along if their first encounter each day were like this, instead of a grumble from a waitress or a bus driver or a boss? "I believe in being fully present," Maury said. "That means you should be with the person you're with. When I'm talking to you now, Mitch, I try to keep focused only on what is going on between us. I'm not thinking about something we said last week. I am not thinking of what's coming up this Friday. I am not thinking about doing another Ted Koppel show or about what medications I'm taking. I am talking to you. I'm thinking about you." I remembered how he used to teach this idea in the group process class back at Brandeis. I had scoffed back then, thinking this was hardly a lesson plan for a university course. Learning to pay attention? How important could that be? I now know it's more important than almost everything they taught us in college. Maury motioned for my hand, and as I gave it to him, I felt a surge of guilt. Here was a man who, if he wanted, could spend every waking moment in self-pity, feeling his body for decay, counting his breaths. So many people with far smaller problems are so self-absorbed, their eyes glaze over if you speak for more than 30 seconds. They already have something else in mind by that point, a friend to call, a fax to send, a lover they're daydreaming about. They only snap back to full attention when you finish talking, at which point they say, "uh-huh," or "yeah, really," and fake their way back to the moment. "Part of the problem, Mitch," Maury said, "is that everyone is in such a hurry. People haven't found meaning in their lives, so they're running all the time, looking for it. They think the next car, the next house, the next job. Then they find those things are empty too, and they keep running." "Once you start running," I said, "it's hard to slow yourself down." "Not so hard," Maury said, shaking his head. "Do you know what I do? When someone wants to get ahead of me in traffic, when I used to be able to drive, I would raise my hand." He tried to do this now, but the hand lifted weakly, only 6 inches. "I would raise my hand as if I was going to make a negative gesture, and then I would wave and smile. Instead of giving them the finger, you let them go and you smile. And you know what? A lot of times they smiled back. The truth is, I don't have to be in that much of a hurry with my car. I would rather put my energies into people." Maury did this better than anyone I've ever known. Those who sat with him saw his eyes go moist when they spoke about something horrible, or crinkle in delight when they told him a really bad joke. He was always ready to openly display the emotion so often missing from my baby boomer generation. We are great at small talk. What do you do? Where do you live? But really listening to someone? Without trying to sell them something or pick them up or recruit them or get some kind of status in return. Well, how often do we do that anymore? I believe many visitors in the last months of Maury's life were drawn not because of the attention they wanted to pay to him, but because of the attention he paid to them. Despite his personal pain and decay, this little old man listened the way they always wanted someone to listen. I told him he was the father everyone wishes they had. "Well," Maury said, closing his eyes, "I have some experience in that area." The last time Maury saw his own father was in a city morgue. Charlie Schwartz was a quiet man who liked to read his newspaper alone under a street lamp on Tremont Avenue in the Bronx. Every night, when Maury was little, Charlie would go for a walk after dinner. He was a small Russian man with a ruddy complexion and a full head of grayish hair. Maury and his brother David would look out the window and see their father leaning against the lamppost, and Maury wished he would come inside and talk to them, but he rarely did, nor did he tuck them in, nor did he kiss them goodnight. Maury always swore he would do these things for his own children, if he ever had any, and years later, when he did have them, he did. Meanwhile, as Maury raised his own children, Charlie was still living in the Bronx. He still took that walk. He still read the paper. One night, he went outside after dinner. A few blocks from home, he was accosted by two robbers. "Give us your money," one said, pulling a gun. Frightened, Charlie threw down his wallet and began to run. He ran through the streets and kept running until he reached the steps of a relative's house, where he collapsed on the porch. Heart attack. He died that night. Maury was called to identify the body. He flew to New York and went to the morgue. He was taken downstairs to the cold room where the corpses were kept. "Is this your father?" the attendant asked. Maury looked at the body behind the glass, the body of the man who had scolded him and molded him and taught him to work, who had been quiet when Maury wanted him to speak, who had told Maury to swallow his memories of his mother when he wanted to share them with the world. Maury nodded at the corpse, and he walked away. The horror of the room, he would later say, sucked all other functions out of him. He did not cry until days later. Still, his father's death helped prepare Maury for his own. This much he knew. There would be lots of holding and kissing and talking and laughter, and no goodbyes left unsaid, all the things he missed with his father and his mother. When the final moment came, Maury wanted his loved ones around him, knowing what was happening. No one would get a phone call or a telegram. No one would have to look through a glass window in some cold and foreign basement. In the South American rainforest, there is a tribe called the Desana, who see the world as a fixed quantity of energy that flows between all creatures. Every birth must therefore engender a death, and every death bring forth another birth. This way, the energy of the world remains complete. When they hunt for food, the Desana know that the animals they kill will leave a hole in the spiritual well, but that hole will be filled, they believe, by the souls of the Desana hunters when they die. Were there no men dying, there would be no birds or fish being born. I like this idea. Maury likes it too. The closer he gets to a goodbye, the more he seems to feel we are all creatures in the same forest. What we take, we must replenish. It's only fair, he says.